Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yes! Van Helsing is a fellow philosophy graduate!
Yes, yes, yes! Yes!
Britain. An ancient kingdom with legends of violence, cruelty, and torment in its blood. Join your hosts, Ross, John, and James, as they bravely tread where few would dare. Witness their journey into the horrific history of British horror. They are the General Witchfinders.
Ladies and gentlemen, goblins and ghouls, and welcome back somehow to now the 40th episode. 40, you heard that right. 40th episode of the General Witchfinders podcast. I'm James in Bournemouth in southern England.
I'm John Pountney. I'm locked in this room by Ross Cleaver. I was locked here 3 years ago. I can't get out. Can someone please come and release me? It's in South,
South
Wales.
Wales.
I can't. You're just going to have to try and find me because I can't give you any more precise details than that, unfortunately.
I'm Ross in Dorchester in southern England, and this time we married the Brides of Dracula.
What? That doesn't make sense, Chris. It's fine. Yeah. Go with it.
Listen to the beat of your heart, Marianne. You hear the beat of fear within you. Fear that will rise to a shattering crescendo of terror. You have strayed into a world of evil, where frightened people are held in the grip of unearthly horror. Beware of pity for the handsome prisoner in the Castle Meister. Beware of love, for in your heart is only the pulsating throb of terror. Starring Peter Cushing as the Doctor locked in mortal combat with overwhelming evil. Also starring Freda Jackson as Greta, who served the vampires with insane loyalty.
You needn't be afraid, she's dead.
Martita Hunt, the Baroness, victim of her own son. Beautifully Von Molor, France's latest sex kitten, as Marianne, whose beauty was her passport to the twilight world of the undead. David Peel as the Baron, blindingly handsome, yet his kiss transformed the most beautiful girls into monsters.
So, Dracula the Damned is a 1960 British supernatural horror film produced by Hammer Film Productions, starring Big Chris Lee and... No, hold on a minute. Scratch that.
I was going to say,
Rather, the original sequel to the first Hammer Dracula film, which that should have been, was cancelled without explanation,
although Christopher Lee's decision not to return due to fear of typecasting probably led to The Brides of Dracula, today's film, taking place. And Big Chris Lee did, in fact, return 5 years later when he starred in Dracula, Prince of Darkness.
An inferior film, I think.
So the Brides of Dracula is a 1960 British supernatural horror film produced by Hammer Film Productions, directed by Terence Fisher. The film stars, of course, Peter Cushing, David Peel, who wore lifts in his shoes, apparently, to make him the same height as actor Peter Cushing. Peel, according to his bio at the time, was 5'10". Cushing was apparently 6 foot tall. Wow. To make his vampire look distinguishable from Christopher Lee's, Peel wore a full blonde hairpiece, and more about that with that bouffon later. Yvonne Monolore, Andre Melly, Miles Mallison, the hearse driver in the Ealing Chiller compendium Dead of Night, see previous episodes. Marticia Hunt, known for her rich cluster of queens, dowagers, shrews, and evildoers. But it was her brilliant performance as the mad reclusive Miss Havisham, the classic Dickens adaptation, Great Expectations, that earned her international recognition.
And the David Lean one.
Hmm. Yeah.
The only good version.
And Freda Jackson, who was also an alumna of Great Expectations.
Amazing in this, and underutilized. And I'm going to really expound. Is that a word? Expound upon this later on, because she's by far the best thing in this. In fact, Marticia Hunt and her, they should be in spin-offs. I think that they should be brought back from the dead, and Big Finish should do a season with them.
Imagine how successful Big Finish would be if it was in our control. You know?
Well, we could use AI to bring them back from the dead and just have her laughing all the way through.
That mad laugh. Yeah. Very good job.
Oh, I heard myself then. That was weird.
Commitment to the part. So, meanwhile, although the character of Count Dracula does not appear in the film and is instead mentioned only twice. So after the success of Dracula, Hammer commissioned Jimmy Sangster, about more in a moment, to write a sequel titled Disciple of Dracula, about an acolyte of the vampire, with Count Dracula himself only making a cameo appearance. Sangster's script was rewritten by Peter Bryan to remove references to Dracula, whilst adding the character of Van Helsing. The screenplay was then further revised by Edward Percy. Filming began on January the 16th, 1960 at Bray Studios, and the film premiered at the Odeon Marble Arch on July the 6th. It was distributed theatrically on a double bill with The Leech Woman.
I can't say I've heard of The Leech Woman.
Me neither.
I think it's got something to do with like sort of African sort of magic and stuff like that. But look at it.
Brilliant. Okay, so it says the ending was originally planned to have the vampires destroyed by a swarm of bats, but this proved too expensive to stage and shoot.
Yes.
And was also vetoed by Peter Cushing, who did not think his character would perform the black magic required to summon the bats. However, the idea was recycled 3 years later for the climax of Hammer's The Kiss of the Vampire. The prop department put a lot of effort into making a realistic model bat, but it was lost. Ross doesn't provide us with any more details on that, and had to be replaced on short notice. This explains the unconvincing, which is being kind to it, model bat in the movie.
Oh, like the Jumping Jacks Beaver.
What?
What's that? We had a beaver. We had a stuffed beaver in Jumping Jacks, and it went missing, and that was stolen.
Oh, and you have to like mock one up?
We didn't recreate it, but that just made me think the Jumping Jacks beaver. I wonder where he is now. I thought the bat in this was quite good. Compared to the bat in Scars of Dracula, which is horrendously bad.
That was super bad. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Right. So then finally, it says the front door of Oakley Court served as the main entrance to Mainster Castle. Mm. Oakley Court has been featured in a number of classic horror films, including The Curse of Frankenstein, The Horror of Dracula, The Evil of Frankenstein, Die, Monster, Die, great title, and The Rocky Horror Picture Show. So there you have it. That's the introduction.
Yeah, it's quite short because it wasn't like a huge amount to... Although, even though I did watch the making of documentary, which was quite good on the
DVD. Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a couple of kind of like awkward anecdotes in there, which you feel like, oh, it was a different time when they made this.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Maybe don't repeat those then, Cleves.
I'll tell you now, but I'll cut it out. Put herself into yogurt trances. She was like stuck in a trance in there in a knickers and nothing else.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus. Oh, God. Oh, Jesus.
It was just like two fried eggs nailed to a wall.
Yikes.
Really, the casting of both these two actresses was a bit of a
coup
for Hammer at this point. And I think they make the first half of the film very, very successful. For me, it tails off very badly towards the end when it becomes much more Hammer, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, so we start it off then. So we start off with a Universal distribution
thing,
which is quite, I thought was quite unusual. I was trying to look at see how many Hammer films were distributed by Universal, but is it just a case we don't normally see that on the versions we're watching?
The deal came in at some point after Dracula and the success of Dracula, or the horror of Dracula in America, but it meant that they had a big injection of cash. And I think, well, not necessarily a big injection of cash.
Some cash.
Relative cash. And I think that's why this one particularly, and a few after this, look a bit more lavish. Mm. And when you compare this to Curse of Frankenstein and Dracula, this looks a lot more lavish. And it's almost on the kind of Wes Anderson scale of set dressing.
Yeah,
kind of,
I thought it looked really beautiful.
Oh, like, it looks absolutely beautiful. Yeah, definitely.
Well, they was talking about the, I think they called him lighting cameraman back then rather than a cinematographer.
Yeah.
But they were just saying that he would have all these different coloured lights and sort of like have little bits in the background. So, you know, that you'd be like in the, I noticed when they was in the tavern, like there would be like little purple and red lights in the background. The sort of the window panes would have different colour.
Yes.
Bits of glass in there. And it just looked really beautiful. But apparently he just took way too long light and everything. So they replaced him for later films.
Yeah. He actually took care of what the films looked like. So the early Hammers look incredible. The later ones just look like dog shit sometimes.
Yeah, and we got an insane fonts at the beginning as well.
Yeah, the font is probably the most overblown font of all time, isn't it? It's like, it looks like a lot of red carrots, words made out of red carrots in a slightly horrific fashion, spelling out, is it all of the typeface?
Yeah, everything. All of the names were written in this.
Yeah. So it's almost illegible, but quite dramatic.
Yeah, over the top of it, an obvious model of the castle.
Of course. But before we get into that, I often like to scan the credits at the start to see if there's any notable names or things such as that. Because the one that really jumped out at me this time is Jimmy Sangster. And I thought, well, I know that name really, really rings a bell. And Jimmy Sangster, as one of the writers of the film, had a really kind of quite remarkable career, really, in the fact that he wrote a lot of horror and Hammer horror stuff over in this country, but then just said, do you know what? Screw this, as you absolutely should, getting out of this cursed island, quite frankly.
Cursed shithole, yeah.
Absolutely. And he went over to the States, and then in the 80s, the stuff that and late 70s that he did is incredible. He did three episodes of Wonder Woman. He also did episodes of Kolchak the Night Stalker.
No way, did he?
Yeah, which was like a late night staple when we were kind of teenagers, wasn't he? It was chucked in. One episode in 1974. He wrote an episode of The $6 Million Man.
No way.
Yeah. And then, reaching a pinnacle, some would say, in the 1980s, he wrote the teleplay to The Toughest Man in the World, the Mr. T.
Wow.
I think of that so often.
Climaxed, in case people have never seen it, dig it out if you need to, along with Mr. T's incredible album that he released at the time.
And cartoon TV series.
And, well, yeah, of course. But then, as I remember, in The Toughest Man in the World, his whole thing was he couldn't climb up a rope.
Oh, he couldn't climb over a wall. There was a bit of part of it was a big assault course to prove he was the toughest man in the world.
Well, like a Krypton factor.
Yeah, but he couldn't climb over the wall. So at the end, it was neck and neck, but they knew that he was going to lose because he couldn't climb over the wall. And what did he do, James?
He just runs straight through the wall rather than climbing through it. He crashes through it.
Yes.
Which is a very dramatic. Again. So, nice. So thank you, Jimmy Sangster.
An amazing career trajectory, a bit like Val Guest, where you start. And then you just don't know where you're going to end up. And that's the kind of career it's so hard to say.
Trajectory
that I'm really hoping for.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I really want to end up directing sex films in my 50s. if Britain carries on the course where it's going, it's going to end up like a kind of quasi-Nigel Neal future state where people drive around in Land Rovers with mesh over the windows.
Yeah, the sex Olympics.
And I'm going to be directing sex films at that point.
Yeah. And...
From a wheelchair.
This film has also given me some thoughts about a career, but I'll talk to you about them when we get to it.
Apparently, apparently Peter Cushing was slagging off the script to Christopher Lee at one point. And he said, I don't have many lines in this new film. And he was like, who wrote it? And he was like, he said Sangster, and he said, well, count yourself lucky.
Saucer for milk, table three.
It's just, they do my head in.
So we get into it. We get into our plot, and we're told we get a voiceover.
Oh, brilliant voiceover!
What have I said? Dodgy voiceover for context. I've said
Transylvania, land of dark forests, dread mountains, and black, unfathomed lakes. Still the home of magic and devilry as the 19th century draws to its close. Count Dracula, monarch of all vampires, is dead, but his disciples live on to spread the cult and corrupt the world.
And we're told that Dracula is being destroyed. However, you know, people that he turned into vampires are still roaming the land and are still roaming free. Quite a nice idea, I thought.
He was the monarch of the vampires, apparently.
Yes. Although, you know, the mad thing about vampires is like all the various different lore different writers come up with this twaddle, quite frankly.
Things are always added, aren't they?
So sometimes you have people saying, oh well, if you kill the one vampire, every person that he's turned into a vampire, they then all die, and things like, oh my god, there's all different things, isn't there? However, we're also told in the voiceover, it says Transylvania, so in other words, Romania, fact fans. When they says land of huge lakes and dread mountains, which I've not pictured, because this is I've been to Transylvania, I've been to Castle Dracula, it looks nothing like this.
Yes, this is just a wood outside London somewhere, isn't it?
I was watching this again. I was watching this with Beck, and she's, oh, where do you think this was filmed? I said, well, Bray Studios. It would just be like just outside the house.
Every time.
An incredibly muddy time of the year as well.
For me, that's what makes them so intensely comforting, is that you know exactly where you are. You know that there's a guy stood behind the camera, probably smoking a pipe in a cardigan, who's just driven there in an MGB and just like, oh, morning chaps, you know, oh God, here we are again. And they dash one of these off in like 4 weeks or something, 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And then they just make another one. And that's why, you know, that's why I admire people like Jimmy Sangster, because he dashed off reams and reams and reams of these scripts just to entertain people. They weren't trying to make high art. They were just trying to just make potboilers for people to enjoy. The main thing I thought at the start of this film was that the music was very stodgy, and it's not by the James Bernard, who does the usual Dracula, Dracula music. So it's just got, you don't hear Count, what's he called in this? I can't even remember. Count David Peel.
Meister.
Count Meister. You don't hear that, do you? There's no kind of riff.
There was a lovely bit of music every time Van Helsing gets out his crucifix, I thought.
I
which I think is music from Dracula.
Oh, okay.
Which is the same music at the end of Dracula when he, I'm sure, when he gets the crucifix out and pushes Dracula into the sunlight at the end of Dracula. Yeah. I'm sure that's from the previous film. Because they obviously thought, oh, we haven't got the crucifix music. We're just going to paste it in from the film we made 5 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
So we start with a mad... The first hour of this is a very, very good gothic fairy tale film, isn't it? You start with a very good gothic carriage ride. Michael Ripper is the
coachman,
ubiquitous coachman in every Hammer film ever. He stops to
there's a lock in the road,
log, and then you see a man who looks a bit Christopher Lee-ish or a bit Michael Gwynn in Revenge of Frankenstein, and then you see this guy a couple of times and then you never see him again.
Yeah, it was kind of like, so he apparently he was a leftover from another version of the script which didn't have Van Helsing in it. But it doesn't make any sense. So like, so it's implied, I think, that this man has put the log in the road to stop the carriage so that he can get on the back of the carriage.
Yes.
And then go into town. But when they arrive at the town,
he just gets off.
He gets off and he pays the coachman some money.
Yeah.
So it's implied that they are in it together to get this woman to be delivered to the woman. But it's like, but I, why was he kind of like hiding? And
yes, he doesn't need to hide. He could just get on the carriage normally because the woman doesn't know him. We only see him as the audience. So none of that makes sense at all, does it?
But I was thinking whilst watching that, it is on my bucket list to go have a carriage ride in one of those carriages.
Have you read the Haunted Carriage, I think it's called, by Amelia B. Edwards Cleaves?
No, I haven't. Is it good?
I think it's my favourite short story of all time. Mm-hmm. I think it's The Haunted Carriage by Amelia B. Edwards. And it's basically a guy who gets lost in the moors and he gets picked up by the post carriage.
Mm.
But then he realizes that everyone else in the post carriage is dead. Mm. Cool. It's a brilliant, brilliant Victorian horror story.
Gotcha.
And it should be a Mark Gatiss Christmas special, cool, of which we can discuss later. It has been announced for this year.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not M.R. James this year.
No. So stay tuned to find out.
If you haven't seen the BBC press release, which was about a month ago.
Yeah.
I think this year flew under the radar a bit because there was a bit of a fuss last year when they said Count Magnus. But this year I had to look for it.
There's a lot of Who going on at the moment, though, isn't there?
There's a lot of Who. The Whoniverse.
Yeah.
So our heroine, if we can say, she's not really a heroine. She's kind of a protagonist until...
she's quite meek, isn't she?
She is. Until Van Helsing turns up, she's kind of our kind of access point to the story.
Yes.
Anyway, she's called... We learn in a bit that she's called Marianne Danielle. Not Suzanne Danielle, which is a name from the Aces of the Teenagers.
One of the best-looking women of all time.
Yes.
In the Hammer House of Horror TV series when she's in a basque. And, awesome. Oh, Lord above her. I had to turn the TV off and go for a walk after that.
So it's not Suzanne Danielle, it's Marianne Danielle. And we learn that she is on her way to basically what turns out to be teacher training college.
Yeah.
Isn't that? Yeah.
As far as I can make out.
In someone's house, isn't it?
Yes, so they kind of like the line is that she's going to go and study, although when she actually gets there, it seems to be that she's teaching already. It doesn't matter too much.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Michael Ripper drops her off in traditional gothic Eastern European semi-abandoned town and tells her to go into the local kind of hostelry,
which is called
the Running Boar.
Yes.
It's rare they give him a name, isn't it?
I really, really... in my life, want to go to a place which looks like this and go in it and have goulash and whatever else. Yeah. It's a very, for a Hammer film, it's, I think it's on a soundstage. Again, it's a quite a lavish set.
It's next to it. So on the making, they had like a plan of what, where they built all the different sets and everything.
Okay.
So they had the house, which had like a soundstage built on the back, and that had, that was the main set with like the, of the castle with the dining room and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they had a bit on the side where they would have like the outdoor courtyard bit, and there was like an old like shed which they would always build the all the taverns and stuff, because it wasn't soundproof, so that they could only film stuff which was going to be loud in there, so that it would mask any noise from outside.
It's quite a good set, though. It's very atmospheric, and the inside of the inn is very nice as well, isn't it?
Yeah, none of the Transylvanians speak with any Romanian accent.
No, and the priest we meet later sounds Irish.
Yeah.
I wondered, obviously I don't think they thought this through, but and this is the second episode in a month in a row I've mentioned The Hunt for Red October. That features one of the coolest things I've ever seen them do. Like at the start of the film, they're all speaking Russian. And then it kind of camera zooms into the character's mouth, and then mid sentence he flips from Russian into English.
That's a good idea.
And then they're all speaking, thus giving you the idea that they're all speaking Russian, you're hearing them speak English, and the various different Russian accents are then the transposed English accents.
So
that's what I always go with.
Chernobyl, yeah, that's what they did.
Yes, very similar to that, Ross. Yes, good shout.
Yeah,
which is brilliant. If you haven't watched Chernobyl, watch Chernobyl.
I watched the Fires of Pompeii today when they were saying that everyone. It's being translated by the TARDIS.
Yes.
Yeah. But if you speak Latin, it comes out as Welsh.
Fair enough.
I think they invented that kind of idea in The Mask of Mandragora, which is filmed in Wales in Portmeirion. There we are. Carry on.
It's all links. Right, so when Marianne walks into the bar, it's that classic thing of it all goes quiet and everyone turns and looks at her. And I wanted to ask you guys, has that ever happened to you?
Yeah, the Drax arms in Bear Regis.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a sleeper t-shirt on the time, and the guy came up to me and asked if I was gay.
to be fair, please. Better point. I once went into the maddest pub ever in Merthyr. Oh. And it was like I'd gone through a time portal. I was looking for a Bruce Davidson photo setting, which is in a place called Caipantawyllt, which is not easy to say. And it's famously like an Alice in Chains cover or someone like that, or Bruce Springsteen or someone. This photo is quite famous. So anyway, I went into this pub, and I went from 2018 into 1979, because this pub is basically like someone's lounge with a bar. And then on the bar was sat like a 9-year-old girl in a very 70s looking school uniform who was basically serving.
Time slip, John. It's a time slip.
It was really weird. And I was just like, hi, like, am I in Caipantawyllt? And they were like, yeah, what do you want? And I was like, oh, I'm just looking.
Was that the voice of the 9-year-old girl?
Yeah. Well, there was a bloke in there as well.
Yeah.
And it was just fucking mental. And I walked out and was like, whoa, that was just so strange. And I've never been back, and I probably never will go back.
You go back and it would be just a ruin. They said, no, that place burnt down in 1976.
Yes. So that was very odd indeed. But most of Merthyr is like a time slip, to be honest. There's no surprises.
My one was one of my disastrous former relationships when I was around about sort of 28, 29. We went to visit her mum, who lived on sort of like the sort of outskirts of London, and lived kind of like on the edge of an estate. And she, and the girlfriend
Quatermass 2E estate, James.
Oh, sort of. She said, oh, there's a pub nearby. We'll go and get a drink. And I said, okay. And it was one of those classic flat roof pubs on an estate. And you know, like straight away, like, oh, my spider senses started tingling. I thought, this ain't right. This isn't good. Yeah. Even at that point, I knew, don't ever drink in a pub.
Well, what is it about those flat roof pubs?
Just terrible.
I went to a club like that in Swansea once where they... you were served the drinks through a slit in the wall, and it was like beer with the plastic on the top. And then
dance, sure that wasn't prison.
No. And on the dance floor, there was big metal barrels for you to chuck your empties into the.
Amazing, yeah. But anyway, so yes, interesting to see that out of the various far-fetched things which we've seen on this podcast, that's the first thing we can all truly empathise.
Yeah. Yeah. So what happened there, James?
We just then had a really uncomfortable kind of drink for about an hour, featuring various locals just looking over and staring at us. It wasn't too bad because she had been there a couple of times before.
Yeah.
And so had that kind of, I'm not a total outsider, but you could tell they were not pleased with me.
So
and
weird, isn't it?
Clearly liberal tendencies.
Yeah. A pub like that in Ely, in Cardiff, where you drive past now, and there used to be a dog on the roof and stuff, and like an Alsatian sat on the roof. And for about the past 10 years, it's been a burned out shell now. Yeah. It's just, what is it about the flat roof pubs? There is some kind of folk horror
thing,
ley line thing happening with flat roof pubs, isn't there?
Do you remember when I used to live on that flat near the train station in Weymouth?
Yeah.
So we went to a pub. There was a pub on the corner we never went to. And one time we go there. And we put our dinner in the oven. And I said, "You think it'd be fine?" He said, "Yeah, it's only like three doors down." So we put it in there and went to this pub. And it went absolutely silent. And there was a three-legged greyhound, really sad-looking one, like limped, hopped over towards us. There was a man with a parrot on his shoulder, covered in like bird shit.
Wow.
No music at all. You know, everyone's just sitting in there, like looking at you. And then we heard a fire engine going off, and I was convinced our flat was on fire. So I basically ordered a drink and then just ran away.
Oh, dear God.
Whilst Becca was then kind of press ganged into finding Long John Silver's treasure by the sounds of things.
Arm wrestling contest.
Yeah, I've had arm wrestling contest with sailors in
Oh, man. Okay. Yeah. Look. So I'm sorry, I started this. Sorry, dear listener. More one stars coming. Yeah. But anyway, right. So Marianne sits in the pub, and we're just told it's a bit of a strange town. What would you say the vibe coming off it is? Is
backwater.
It like we don't get a lot of people
like
staying here?
Lamb.
Transylvanian backwater. Yeah, it's very slaughtered lamb, but 24 years before. Only 24 years before. And
that's
it feels
insane.
Like
that's insane.
It's mad, isn't it? Yeah. Isn't it mad?
We then have the arrival, incredibly, of Baroness Meister. Everything goes very, very strange as
everyone runs off. Yeah,
well, you don't expect a woman, do you? You expect the man in the cape to come back, and I think that's the point, that the big reveal is that it's the woman with the amazing face that comes in, and you're like, oh, who's this then?
So this is the first example of many in this film where people order food or are given food.
Yeah.
Don't eat or drink any of it and then leave without paying.
That's what I thought.
There's a difference.
Yes.
Amazingly, she just walks in through the door and just goes, wine. And they bring her wine. I thought, oh, I'd love to be able to be in that position. It's wine. just bring it to me.
if it was me, I'd say fried chicken.
So this mysterious lady, we are told, is the Baroness Meister, who is so obviously kind of like the rich, the gentry of the town.
Yes,
everyone is very, very suspicious of her. She kind of sidles up to Marianne and sort of establishes that she's just passing through. We then also find out that the coachman, Michael Ripper's, legged it.
Yes.
Kind of leaving her abandoned for the night. And she's like, oh, it's okay. I'll stay here in this Wetherspoons. That's what it is for all intents and purposes. The Baroness says, look, you shouldn't have to stay with these peasants. Come and stay with me up in the castle. Which I've just put, that's like getting an Airbnb upgrade, isn't it? She's like, don't come and stay in this pub, this drafty old pub. Come and stay in my posh castle. To which Marianne absolutely accepts and says, fantastic, let's go. Off to the castle they go together.
So at what point, what happens to her baggage? Because the baggage is not left by the carriage, which was taken away. But later on, she has a change of clothing. And then, and then another point, she turns up with some baggage. So What's happening with the baggage?
Who knows?
I've no idea. And then they talk about baggage which he's left behind, don't
yes,
they?
Yes.
Yeah. No, that's a good point, Cleves. I hadn't thought of that.
But a second carriage, and I thought, well, bit of money here. They're not just reusing the same carriage.
Which no.
They've had all redressed it, so...
American yeah. money, Cleves. Yeah. See, that's yeah. what it is.
Yeah.
We're introduced then to Greta, who is basically the Mrs. Danvers character in this,
yes.
As in Rebecca.
Freda Jackson.
Who is the mean stepmother in Great Expectations, I think, isn't she? Whoa, these are both serious, proper actresses.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they click in, you're like, this is, for a Hammer, this is like, this is really good. And I think these scenes are just great because it's all like setting the scene and it's this kind of inexorable... At this point, you think that the old lady, the mother, is the villain of the piece,
yes.
don't you?
Yes.
There's no
yeah,
kind
very
of...
Much.
You, I mean, that's what's difficult with watching these Hammers is that for all of my life now, thanks to reading the Dennis Gifford book or the other book about the Hammer films, I know exactly who the villain is, whereas... You try and go in fresh to it. Obviously, everything that presents here is that the mad housekeeper and the mother are the villains, and they're keeping the son captive in some way.
Well, yeah, but so we don't know about the son yet.
Well, you haven't met the son yet. No, no. At this point, you think he's dead, don't you?
Well, they kind of they're talking about. Like, she noticed that the dinner is set for two,
yes.
And there's and then she goes out onto the balcony and she sees a guy.
It's a nice set.
Yeah, really nice set. And it's really obviously not done on two different floors.
No. Yes.
But they have a really good, great, so looking down and it's got that
mystery. Yeah, 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 yeah.
And it does feel, yeah, you know, like a very classic sort of gothic tale of that there's someone yeah. in the building
yes.
which everyone's denying exists. And,
yeah.
you know, I think that if this was a modern film, you could have sort of played out, well, is that a ghost? You know,
yeah.
or because there's a point where she sees and then looks away and he's no longer there. And and again, just looks beautiful. The colours, the way it's lit and everything is fantastic.
Having settled in for the evening, Marianne and the Baroness sit down for dinner. And she's like, I always set a second plate at dinner in case I have any company. And I thought, oh, that's really wishful thinking, isn't it? Really? But still. And she says to her, look, you may go anywhere in this house, but not through that door. You know, kind of classic.
Yeah.
And then she says, oh, you know, I saw somebody. And then first of all, does she deny that there's anybody there?
Yes. Yeah,
yes. She's so. Like, no, you didn't. She's like, no, but you know, but I did. She's like, if I was you, forget about it. Mm. Of course, naturally she doesn't. And later on that night in quite a good, as we've just been saying, a really good shot, she goes out onto the balcony from her bedroom again, only to see this guy. And he's now stood right on the edge of his balcony.
As if he's going to throw himself off.
As if he's about to throw himself off. And she's like, don't do it. Don't throw yourself off. And he's like, oh, would that I could, my lady. And then he says, I'm her son.
Yeah.
And
she's locked me up. Yeah,
and she's locked me in there, and she's like, oh my god, no, this is dreadful. And I have put down that she's won over very quickly,
yes.
very easily,
very
by a guy. And the reveal is that he's chained by his ankle,
yes.
which I think is a brilliant reveal at this point.
Yeah,
again, is massively gothic, and it's just like the guy that's chained into luxury, essentially, isn't he? Which is a brilliant idea.
We were talking about that. While I was making dinner, just saying how it's nice. It was a silver. They don't go into like the vampiric lore about the silver, but it's a silver yeah. chain and all that kind of stuff. Beck was wondering, yes. like, does that mean he never changes out of those clothes? And, and because like you would have, they would have to take the chains off him. And also, how does he get if he is eating with his mother? What the second place, which is oh no. I'm thinking that's why it wasn't there. But she knew that the woman was going to be delivered there, wasn't she?
Because yes.
she's paid. That's why people. Second place was set. Yes, I get
you
it.
Find out that people are delivered there all the time, don't you? That they go out of their way to kind of get people there. I think as a vampire, you basically just sleep in your clothes, don't you?
Yeah.
You don't sweat. You don't kind of dirty your clothes like a human being does. You just kind of exist spiritually.
Do they really sweat?
Because well, no, exactly. Kind of yeah, yeah. They're dead, aren't they? So it's just kind of.
I seem to remember, like, they cry and sweat blood, don't they?
Oh, do they?
Yeah. But, you know, again.
Where'd you get that from?
Probably
please?
Anne Rice. Yeah.
No, I thought you were going to say, like, I once got a card out of a Weetabix box. which said that they cry and sweat blood.
Miss Danielle, or, you know, who decides that she is going to go and release the young master. And she does so.
In her dressing gown.
And then it's kind of all hell is let loose. Because does he just like then immediately scarper?
There's a nice little scene with her having to go and get the key from...
Yes.
Oh, that was it. I remember now, yeah.
So that's when you still think the mother is the villain, don't you?
Because yes.
She's got an amazing costume on, but she has the kind of creepy music at that point.
Yeah. And there's a bit of like when you think she's going to be found, but she's actually hiding outside the window and
yeah,
stuff.
Up
until this point, really, it's all really good. I'm enjoying it.
I've written at this point 25 minutes in and still no Cushing.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
The mother and son then are kind of reunited. Have I jumped a bit?
When she finds out that she's let him go, she starts shitting herself, the mother. And then the
maid?
I want to say vampire, but I'm giving away the vampire, basically.
Careful, right? Careful.
So the young girl is running away from the mother, and then the vampire chap is...
Oh, he turns up in his cape,
in his cape,
he?
Yeah.
Yes.
And then essentially commands her to leave her alone.
Yes. Yeah. And then he hypnotises his mother, doesn't he? So that scene is great because he's like, mummy, kind of like Prince Charles when he was talking about the Queen in like the, all the, you know, the jubilees and stuff.
Yeah.
And I really like that kind of dynamic. And unfortunately, there's not enough of that dynamic, is there, between mother and son? I think that could be really good if they
Yeah, and then essentially
that.
He allows the young girl to escape. And then he's sort of like left in the house with his mum. And then you find out later on what he does to his mother. At that point. Yeah, but when you was talking about quickly convincing the young girl to help her escape,
I think
that he is hypnotizing her because you are seeing elements of mesmerism. Mm. Like he controls his mother at this point. There's points later on where, you know, she finds out that the Baron has killed the mother, but still goes on to agree to marry him and stuff like that. So he's obviously either she's stupid or this guy has got some kind of mind control over people.
Yeah. When do we find out now that Greta's gone absolutely loopy and is
right,
just laughing?
Right now. It's a weird kind of scream / laugh. I put down it's the most disturbing bit of the film. She goes absolutely bonkers. She is, she is a bit like, who is the house, like the housemaid in Father Ted?
Mrs. Doyle.
Mrs. Doyle, thank you, Ross. Yeah. She's a bit like Mrs. Doyle on acid.
Yeah.
She's like, she like facilitates, she oscillates between like, oh my God, what have you done to her?
Yeah. Yes.
You know, she's out there.
It's a brilliant performance. It's one of the best performances in a Hammer film.
Yeah.
And then she finds the dead body of the mother at that point.
Yes.
And also the coffin.
Yeah.
We see.
Then you have the coffin reveal, which is brilliant. Mm. And I love all that.
So up to that point, if you didn't know, you wouldn't know he was a mother up until that point.
Exactly.
No.
Exactly. So, and so the maid says, oh, he'll be back. He has to come back here. You know, because they have to go back to their coffins with the
native
earth,
their
homeland in, and all the rest of it. So that is kind of like dun dun dun, end of act one, and then after that, Peter Cushing arrives to classy this production even further.
31 minutes in, Cushing arrives.
So he essentially finds Marianne collapsed in the woods because she's been running all night to try and get away from
the castle.
Bad fuck up. There's no other word for it, really, is there? You've been invited back to someone's house. You find out that the mother is now dead. The maid has gone insane. And the guy that you thought you were saving is actually a vampire. That's a bad night out. Oh,
isn't it's all gone wrong. Isn't it?
I know it's happened to you a few times, Cleves. A few times in Jago's.
It's gone worse than that, John.
I'm sorry.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Right, where were we?
They're in the carriage. And part of the conversation, Peter was like,
"Oh yes,
have you ever heard of the cult of the undead?
Yeah,
it's out of the frying pan into the fire for this poor young girl."
I think the bit that that's really good is the wake, and that's very atmospheric, and that's got a good bit of. You see all the garlic and stuff, and it's the coffin has got a nice kind of Eastern European blanket in it, and you just think, God, they really took care in these films because. Some of the later films, particularly Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, just feel so rushed and kind of like stuck together with blue tack, whereas these films actually look like they're existing in a filmic universe of quite a specific kind.
Yeah.
You know, like I mentioned earlier, Wes Anderson universe. At this point, they looked a bit like a Hammer universe. I mean, later on, they didn't give a shit as long as there were naked women in them. But I think these ones do look really very glossy.
Which about Wes Anderson or Hammer? Because there was a lot of gratuitous nudity in some of the recent Wes Anderson stuff as well. Was like,
is there?
Yeah.
Like, which film?
The French one. It's like
the French one.
The one where we're about in the newspaper in France, and Scarlett Johansson is like naked for like half an hour in it. You know, I haven't
seen that one, but if you can send me a link, please.
It's on Disney Plus.
It's Disney.
Yeah. All the Wes Anderson stuff's on Disney, isn't it?
The world's gone mad, hasn't it?
I noted that because I looked at Peter Cushing and I thought, you know, because Cushing always looked a certain age. And I thought that thing of people back in the 50s, though, aging rapidly. I thought he's probably about 32 in this film, isn't he? And I also noted that close up when they showed him, he reminded me he looks quite a lot like Tom Hiddleston in this.
Oh, yeah.
Sweatback hair,
And I wondered if there was some sort of thespian DNA in this country that we all...
Because
people often say that, like, you know, like Hiddleston's a bit like Richard E. Grant.
Yes.
And I was like, there's almost like a line between, you know, like a line from the three of them.
Yeah.
Different eras of angular thespian men.
Mm.
One of the things we're often asked is, like, what... Because we are now at the start of a new era of Hammer. It's been bought by
Are you... When you say we, are you talking about us three here?
The podcast.
Right.
On our Twitter, General Witch One.
A
topic which comes up often is, I think they want us to talk about, is the new era of Hammer. What would we do? Because I know because we've got the Eddie Izzard, Jekyll and Hyde film coming out soon.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. What are people saying about that, Cleves?
Not a lot, really.
I've seen one review saying it is absolutely abysmal. And I've seen one review going, Eddie Izzard is always worth watching, but everything else in this film is bad.
Yeah. He changes by having a green spliff. Or they turn into...
Yes, Cleves, don't put any of this in or we're going to get cancelled.
But one of the things they keep saying, if they were going to bring back Dracula... in the universe, who would we cast as Dracula and Van Helsing? So I think a lot of people are saying Ralph Fiennes as Van Helsing, but I think he's too old, personally.
Yeah, he's too old.
Yes.
But Tom Hiddleston could do it, I think.
Hiddleston would rock it. Yeah.
I think that if I was going to do it, you would just want unknown actors and you wouldn't want...
Yeah.
Because I just think it's really difficult now to be like, we'd have so-and-so and we'd have so-and-so, because they come with so much
baggage.
Yeah.
And they're always much older than you think, aren't they? Like, you go, yeah, he could do it. He's 56. You know?
Yeah. Whereas, you know, Cushing was quite famous at the point they did Dracula as a TV actor. Mm. No one knew who Christopher Lee was. That was the point. Everyone was like, who's this really handsome young guy? Mm. Whereas, you know, if you cast, and that's a bit like, you know, when Matt Smith was Doctor Who, he'd only really been in one thing before that, which me and Hel watched by chance with...
Party Animals, wasn't it?
Well, no, it was the Ruby and the Smoke we had seen with
Billy Piper,
which was really good. That was the main kind of thing that he was known for. So I think, if I was going to redo Hammer stuff now, it would be some really good up-and-coming theatre actors rather than, you know, a person who was a big name, because...
I love the guy who played Dracula in the Stephen Moffat stuff. I think he was brilliant.
He was really good.
Who's also very good in The Northman.
Yeah,
as well.
He's amazing. Mm-hmm.
Terrific, isn't
I thought that was a very good performance.
Yeah, I felt like the third part of that just it went off the rails. But
I didn't like any of it.
Oh, I like the first one a lot.
Oh, what, Dracula?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
I didn't like any of it. I thought it was silly.
Yeah, but I thought he was excellent as Dracula.
I think I'm just sick. I just want to see a Dracula where they just do the fucking book story, because every single one is like, this is Dracula. And then you watch it and you're like, it's not the fucking story. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's totally different. He's an old guy with a mustache who looks like,
palms.
Exactly. Who looks quite animalistic. Mm. And then you've got Gary Oldman, or you've got fucking God knows who. Mm. So that's what I do, is that kind of, and I'd film it in Whitby. Yeah. Because they never go to Whitby, and they never use the really amazing atmosphere of Whitby, which is incredible. I think the only one that really uses Whitby is the BBC 1977 one, which Cleves.
Yeah, it will be doing this year, won't
we? This coming year, 2024. It's a big year, listeners.
Yeah, we've got the whole year mapped out. Already one change might have been happening, but we'll see.
Why?
Because someone suggested something would look really good. So just one last thing about the Dracula. If we were going to do a new Dracula, would you set it in now, or would you set it back when it was meant to be?
I would do what the book is.
Yeah.
I'd set it in 1890s, Whitby, Transylvania and London, Carfax Abbey. I'd have Dr. Sayward, I'd have the whole thing, and I wouldn't piss about with it. Because it doesn't need messing about with. You just make it verbatim to the book. It's like Shakespeare. You don't take Shakespeare and then say, oh, I'm going to fucking... change the whole story. It's just nonsensical.
Okay.
Well, and I've never seen a version which is... I've never seen the version which Christopher Lee always used to talk about, where he had the moustache, which I think was a Spanish film in the 70s.
Of course, he had a moustache.
I've never seen that version, and I'd love to see that.
Señor Big Chris, Chris Lee.
It's Dracula in a spaghetti western.
Wow, wow,
wow. Dracula.
Let's get back to this.
This is where the film starts to go downhill, isn't it?
Van Helsing sits down with Marianne, and there's an amazing bit where he's like, okay, what I want you to do is I want you to write down everything that happened to you, no matter how trivial. And I put in brackets.
And then forget it.
Yes. And I put, write down everything that happened to you, no matter how trivial, and perhaps what underwear you were wearing at the time.
And if you want to do a drawing.
And then, as John says, his then advice is, and then forget it.
And then they turn up at the mainstay of a lot of films in the 70s, a girls' school. For some reason, men of a certain age who are making films in the 60s and 70s thought, what we need to see on screen is a girls' school.
So, yes, this is when we learn. This is where Marianne was supposed to be going in the first place.
Yes.
Van Helsing drops her off. And then to start off with, the headmaster is having none of it and says, I'm not having these ladies being accompanied by anyone. Van Helsing gets out his business cards like in American Psycho.
Yeah, it's says, that part's fucking amazing.
Get your eyeballs around that, sunshine. Van Helsing. And the headmaster is quite rightfully, he's like, oh, Dr. Van Helsing. And now here's my big note for this. This has never been clarified, I don't think, in any of the other Dracula-based literature or media I've ever seen, where I have put, yes, Van Helsing is a fellow philosophy graduate.
Yes.
We're told he's got a philosophy PhD.
Yeah, I was like, of course,
yes. Yes. And I was like, and so now what I've, and here's my, what John was saying about what his late stage career might be.
Cleaver, thought, that's the intro to the whole podcast.
Maybe I could, because Ross is saying that he's going to put an ad for us in what magazine?
Darkside magazine.
In Darkside magazine. And maybe with an addendum now, James is available for necromancy / vampire hunting.
Yeah.
Look, I think I can help here. I've read the Critique of Pure Reason.
Yep. And you can also get them to sort of meditate as well. And
some of that. Because also Van Helsing's also done theology.
Yeah.
So I really loved that. I was like, oh, wow, we finally got Van Helsing's academic background. And hey, you know, there's a little bit of an overlap between I and he. So that was very exciting. And so, yeah, this is when kind of Van Helsing then talks about, like, I think what you were mentioning earlier, Ross, like what the deal is with vampires. And then this could, I think, could be our time to mention the amazing article, the blog post that John found us about this film that said there's more going on in this film than you may realise.
Mm. And who's the lady that wrote it, Cleves? Because I follow her on Twitter and I think we should give her credit for...
Absolutely.
Penelope Goodman.
She's yes!
Senior lecturer of Roman history and Gothic horror. And yeah, a Doctor Who fan. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yes. Well, bravo, Penelope. It's a really great article, and I enthuse all of our listener to go and listen to this. Go and listen to it, or even go and read it, because it's really good. She makes some fantastic points about how this movie is kind of queer-coded in a lot of ways, and how the young Baron, who is now our vampire in this film, has a lot of kind of gay, more of a homosexual feeling to him than Big Chris Lee does.
Who is very
strongly heterosexual, and it's men and women. It's a very different vibe, and that's tied into the fact that one of the rings he wears, and she points out the detail of the fact that the ring he wears is of Alexander the Great, who, of course, Alexander the Great was gay and things such as that, and it's supposed to have been like passed down, which is, again, a nice touch. And then in the article, she also mentions how this is a film that mentions vampirism as folklore, which is the scene that we're talking about right now, when Peter Cushing says, oh, well, you know, these people in this area, they use folklore in order to survive and you know, to structure their lives. And that's very different to a lot of the Hammer things that we've watched and sat through.
But she also talks about how the mother disapproves of his lifestyle. And the things he gets on...
Ashamed of him. There's a big kind of shaming part to it, isn't there?
But also wants to protect him as well. And there's a, you know, that because of his sort of dealings with these people she doesn't like, he's got himself into some kind of trouble, and now it's just like, well, I need to protect him, but and stop him from being like the people he's met and have the life where he wants to have and stuff, and sort of almost sort of.
I think I read the tweets in lockdown at some point, and I thought it was a brilliant subtext for the film, which I hadn't watched for a long time. And I read the article, and I just thought that it was a really clever way of rereading a film, which was made at the time when homosexuality was illegal, and homosexuality in that era was a lot to do with different motifs and symbols and a lot of kind of secret underground, well, not organizations, but, you know, in Soho and places like that, there was the people like Francis Bacon and a lot of people had a very kind of secret kind of almost patois of what they were doing. And I think that, you know, a film like this can only benefit from that reading, because it really enriches the film.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, from this point on, this film becomes quite flat, doesn't it? Which is real shame.
Yes.
When it becomes the kind of vampire chase whodunit kind
formulaic.
Of thing. Yeah. Whereas the first half is this mad fairy tale where once you've read this article, you get this great queer subtext, which is just like the mother is ashamed. She keeps her son hidden. He's got these kind of Byronic curls, which are to do with Alexander the Great and stuff. And you're like, whoa, this makes the film really fun. And then the second half is just a bit, which is really unusual for me because I love Peter Cushing. But as soon as he comes into the film, you're just a bit like, oh, it's just now it's just like Peter Cushing. Yeah, chasing the bad guy. You have a few bits where you have the priest, who is about to be introduced now, who's just a pointless character, sounds Irish. And then later on, you've got the comedic character of the doctor of the village, who is just kind of, I mean, he's fun.
Comic support. But
it's no point of having him in it.
No. Well, he comes too late into the film, doesn't he?
Yeah.
It's just really weird that they introduce his character within the third act of the film. It's just very strange.
But I think my favourite scene comes up here. So essentially, we saw the wake of a young... Because after the vampire has been set loose, one of the village girls dies.
Yes.
And they're having a wake. And then she's buried in the church and they get in trouble for doing that because the priest is saying, how she died... She can't be put into consecrated ground.
Hallowed ground, yep. Yes.
Yeah. And so then Van Helsing is basically on a vigil.
Eavesdropping.
Yeah, and he's on a vigil on the... And then you hear, and it's got the crazy housekeeper laying on the earth.
The grave.
Yes.
And basically, like, helping her...
give birth.
Give birth, yeah. So keep coming, I can't help you, you need to dig your way out and all that. Kind of stuff. And that's my favourite bit. I think that was an excellent... really creepy sort of scene.
Come, wake up, everybody. Are you about ready? Huh? No, I can't help you. You've got to be strong. What? Yes, I know it's dark, but you've got to push. Yes. Push. That's right. Push. Now, just one little effort more. You'll soon be here. Come now. Come, my precious. That's right. Come, my little love. There, the master's waiting for you. There she is. Ah, she comes. There's my little beauty. The clever one.
As a hazmat. It's not buried very, very deep, because when she opens the lid of the coffin, there's probably about 2 centimeters of earth on top of it. But that's when you see one of the first. Okay, this film's called The Brides of Dracula. Dracula's not on it, and there aren't any brides in it either. But this is one of the two female vampires which we see in this film.
Yes,
who essentially Van Helsing has a little bit of a tussle. And then she just runs away, which is something which is like, which happens a lot with his vampiric sort of encounters in this
film. It's quite strange because it starts off as the best scene in the film and then it just goes to be a bit of a damp squib, doesn't it?
Yes.
And it's also the last really good scene in the film because after that, it's a bit, like James says, it becomes a formulaic kind of trotting around different kind of locations and stuff. You see the bat for the first time, which isn't too bad.
Yeah.
I don't think the bat's too bad.
No. They just don't move like bats. Like bats,
No.
These are big, like, bats flap really, really fast.
Yes, the bat's wings flutter, don't they?
Yeah.
In a very kind of strobic way, whereas this kind of glides like a crow or something. And then you...
The Van Helsing goes back to the castle.
Yes.
Yeah, so I get the mother returns, so does Baron Meinster.
Yes. He does that right. And
holding his cape up, put to
his I wondered what the hell you were doing then, Cleves.
Ross has just done an action of the Baron, our vampire, arriving on the scene.
Yes.
And now before I read the article that John sent to us both and is brilliant, and again, go away and read it, I put, he doesn't arrive with big crystally energy. It's a bit more Larry Graham / Graham Norton.
Yeah.
Of an arrival. You Larry like, Grayson.
Yeah. Yes, that's what I meant. Larry Grayson.
Yeah, yeah.
Larry Graham.
Shut that coffin.
The bass player from Sly and the Family Stone. No, doesn't turn up with his energy. Yes. So yes, dear listener, it's a bit more Larry Grayson / Graham Norton of an arrive.
I'm free.
Woo, I'm here.
Yes. Yep. It's very camp. It's very, it's a bit James Brown, isn't it?
Yeah.
He falls down.
Someone.
Yeah. Yeah, and then someone helps him up and puts his cape back on him.
Interesting, he wears grey. He's a grey vampire rather than black as well.
He's very smart. And what I should also say is that Peter Cushing has got a really amazing double-breasted jacket on in this.
Yes, he does.
And he looks the best in any film that he... I mean... I've gone on about his hair for a long time, which then I found out was a toupe, which was a bit disappointing, but he's got a lovely jacket on. What have you got there?
I've just written, Van Helsing's coat is classy.
Oh, it's and really nice, isn't it?
Yeah, it's lovely coat, yeah.
It's quite atypical for kind of 1960s, 1890s film. It's very, very smart kind of Savile Row thing.
So after the Van Helsing is sort of has a little bit of a tussle, and the table gets flipped, and the vampire runs away. He's just left to have quite a nice conversation with the mother, and this is where all of the stuff where she talks about, like, he was involved with these people, and this is kind of what they implied, that he was involved with Dracula, and there was, like, Dracula had, like, some kind of cult going on. And then it's quite nice that he just sits up with her until the morning, and then stakes her.
He says to her, I have a way to kind of cure you. And she kind of does like a beatific smile, doesn't she?
Yes.
Yeah.
But the way is, I'm going to murder you.
Yeah.
It's quite weird.
It's very strange, isn't it?
And the other incredible bit from dialogue that they have is she says to Van Helsing, you'll never catch him. He's too clever. And I've just put typical deluded parent.
Yeah.
As a man who works in education, he's too clever, is he? Well, guess
Boomer
what?
Parent.
I've read his essays, and he is not too clever, and I will easily catch him.
Yeah, he's only going to be in one of three locations, which we keep cycling around, so he's not going anywhere, don't worry.
I've got his bloody coffin.
Yeah.
Come on, game over. Right, yes. So, and then from there, we then learn that they go back to the school, back to the girls' school, and the incredible revelation that the Baron has now started romancing Danielle.
Yeah.
He's Marianne Danielle. He started romancing her, and they're going to get married.
After like...
This is where the film loses
seconds.
Me.
Yeah.
She knows he's a murderer, at least a murderer, maybe not a vampire.
Does she know? At this point?
Yeah, because Van Helsing's told her.
He hasn't told her anything, has he, at this point?
Well, she's seen the mad maid kind of going, ah, ha, 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 what have you done? Yeah, what have you done?
And the body of the mother in the house.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
good point. Does she see the mother?
I don't know if she saw the mother with the...
I don't know if she does.
Yeah, the bite mark,
anyway. You're going to have to check, Cleve.
I'm watching.
But I agree that this is where the film loses me, because it's like the Hammer films often take place in this universe where like a day is made to feel like a year, where people have these relationships that grow. And then when you think about it, it's like you've only met that person this morning. And now you're in love with them and you're going to live with them. And modern Doctor Who often does this. It's like you met that person 10 minutes ago in this episode and now you're going to get married. Mm. And it's a bit like this in this film. Whereas if you, what you said, Cleves, which I think would make more sense, is if he just hypnotized her and said, we are now going to get married, that would fit in much better, wouldn't it? That would fit with his character. That would make the story work. But otherwise, it's just like, why are you marrying this guy? It just doesn't make any sense at all. And then, so then they just carry on then, don't they?
Yeah. So then we have the two women, the two trainee teachers, sort of like talking about how dreamy the Baron is whilst making toast. And,
and she says that she's obviously going to leave to marry him.
Mm.
And my note is, like, as always, it's impossible to keep teachers in the profession. No sooner is she trained up, she's off.
Yeah, the same day.
Same day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then the other trainee teacher was sort of wistfully saying, oh, I wish he would come and whisk me away. But then when Marianne...
She is better looking than Marianne, isn't she? She's got a very unusual face.
Yeah.
And I think she was cast for her looks.
Mm.
And she looks very good as a vampire.
Yeah. Spoilers. So then... so they open the window because she burns the toast and Marianne go downstairs.
Is that what happens?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's how the vampire gets in.
I don't remember any of that.
Yeah. But there's a nice little touch though, because the girl's sitting in front of the mirror.
Yes, talking, that part's good.
And the vampires obviously come in, but she can't see him through the barons come in.
And then she turns around and screams.
Yeah,
and
then becomes vampirized.
And then we start getting a lot of Hammond organ or church organ action in Excelsis. It really, really goes for it. So this is now leading us up to our denouement. We're at that point again. When I looked at how long it had been running for, I was like, this is all going to wrap up in about 10 minutes.
Yeah, well, like any Hammer film.
You know it.
Yeah.
I've just written down, at one point, the headmaster uses the line troglodyte indifference, which I thought was magnificent. It might even be the headmaster. It might have been the doctor.
I think doctor, yeah.
Yeah, I just thought troglodyte indifference was fantastic.
Turns up and disappears. Gonna,
yeah,
the doctor.
Yeah, turns up, disappears.
Yeah.
And we learn that the vampires are now holed up in the local windmill.
Yeah.
Yes, as they do.
Yes. And so Van Helsing decides that he is going to go and obviously confront them. When he gets in there, we now then get...
Almost there.
Yeah, come on. Yeah. And then when he gets inside, first of all, before the main vampire, the Baron turns up, we now see our Brides of Dracula. So it's the girl who's crawled out of the grave.
Yes.
The girl who's just been turned. And dun dun dun, the maid. It turns out that she was a vamp. She'd been vamped, or maybe had been turned at some point all along.
Okay,
who is it?
I wasn't aware that she was a vampire, but yeah.
Well, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, because Cushing gets the old crucifix at her, and she goes wah!
Yeah,
leaps out the way of it.
Yeah, and then falls down the stairs and onto an obvious crash mat.
She's got a very... I thought that was quite a good death. A lot of dust and stuff, and then she... Is she on top of, like, some kind of mine shaft then that disappears and...
Yeah, but she drops the crucifix down there. So
That's right.
All that part works quite well, doesn't it?
Yeah. And then the Baron turns up and you think he's going to do some kind of, like, vampiric sort of attack, but no, he's got a massive chain underneath his...
Before he does all that, Miles' other note was... And we saw this with the old Seven Brides of Dracula. Not Seven Brides of Dracula. What's the Kung
Seven
Fu
Golden
one?
Vampires.
Thank
the
you,
Seven
that one.
Brides for Seven Brothers of
Brothers
Dracula.
Of Golden Vampires. Yeah. Yeah. I noticed that Peter Cushing never looked comfortable in an action scene, does he?
Yeah.
He always looks like he's doing like...
He looks frenetic and kind of stiff, doesn't he?
He does look stiff.
Yeah, and his hair goes awry.
there's some great Cushing choking action, which we haven't seen since the Frankenstein.
Yeah, it's Pertwee-esque at best, isn't it?
In one of our previous episodes, which one of the Frankensteins was it, Ross?
It was the Curse of Frankenstein.
Curse of Frankenstein,
yeah.
We, I think, had as the episode image, or like a fantastic bit when Frankenstein's monster grabs Peter Cushing as Frankenstein, who goes...
Yes. Yes.
And obviously, for the listener, that won't help.
The tongue comes out, doesn't it?
The tongue comes out and his eyes go very, very wide. And
if
it was lovely
imagine,
to see.
If you can imagine John Pertwee being... strangulated by a nestine at the end of Spearhead from Space. Which is the only Doctor Who series to be totally shot on 16mm film.
Thus
being ready-made for Blu-ray. It's almost exactly
People
like
have been
that.
Waiting for that for such a long time.
So long.
How long was it? When did I last mention it?
We haven't said it for a couple of hours.
You'll have a spreadsheet.
So yes, the Baron, the vampire, kind of strangles... Van Helsing, and
then he actually sucks his blood.
Actually, I was going to say there is a twist because you think, is there some sort of rope a dope going on here? Is there going to be like surprise? I'm not unconscious. No, he is unconscious, and he bites him.
Yes.
Like, whoa. Okay. Twist.
Yeah.
I thought he's actually been bitten,
but he doesn't drain him. He just leaves him there, Tim, whilst the brides are sort of just watching.
And I put down, laughing. It is very, very nice of the brides to just stand back and watch this happening.
But this is interesting, because this is the kind of thing which would, being slightly on the spectrum and a weird kid, this would have thrown me into like a tiz of like, what are the rules about being bitten by a vampire?
As we have seen, they are not consistent.
Yeah.
Ross,
so if you've been bitten,
there aren't any.
Yeah, because I thought, well, if you've been bitten,
that's it.
You then become a vampire, or is it a case that you need to be drained, and then they give you some of their blood? Or then I also remember a film when I was a kid. You need to be bit three times to be turned into.
Oh,
what did Anne Rice say?
But apparently on here, all you need to do is to get rid of it is. Heat up a piece of metal and then like
burn your neck,
yeah, and get rid of the scars that way.
But then
and
put holy water,
yeah. on it.
Yeah.
And that was it. Yeah, he was fine.
Then it just fades away.
And so yeah, so despite I thought, oh, I genuinely thought it was going to be a, and now he's got to kill the. My whole thing was, oh, okay, by killing him, he'll then be like, oh, now I'm not a vampire. Yeah. But no, it wasn't even that. As you said, he does this weird cure to himself, which has never been seen before or since.
But they were also saying maybe this is one of the only times you see a vampire in a Hammer film where a male vampire feeds on a man.
And so again, sexuality thing.
The queer and... subtext in this film.
You don't see Christopher Lee bite Jonathan Harker, do you? No, I don't think you do. So this is the first time you see a man-on-man vampire, is it?
I believe so, yeah. One of the few times.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. But again...
What happens?
Well, the brides are watching this the whole time, watching him cure himself. Why aren't they attacking...
I've forgotten to say the bit where the other school teacher comes back. The padlocks dropping off the coffin.
Yes.
Is stolen from Count Magnus by M.R. James.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Anyway, carry on.
Nice. So, but while this is all happening, the Baron has gone away to get the Marianne and bring her back to the windmill for no other reason than... grand finale, which is about it. And then they have a bit of a confrontation and essentially set fire to the...
He throws the holy water over Baron Meinster's face.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's quite a nice makeup effect then of his burned flesh, isn't there? Mm. And then he kicks over...
a brazier.
The brazier where Peter Cushing has heated up the thing to get the thing off his neck.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, weirdly, he is then afraid of the fire he is himself caused.
Yes.
And there's a lot of dubbed sound effects of him going, over and over again. And then Peter Cushing...
They climb up to the top of the windmill.
Does he run upstairs and then out the front of the mill? So basically, the ending is very much stolen from the end of the first Universal Frankenstein.
Yes.
Yes.
But then... Baron Meinster runs outside. He's got his melted face. Peter Cushing jumps on the sails of the windmill to make the shape of the cross.
Yes. And casts the shadow of the cross onto the vampire.
And then that kills him, which seems a bit of an odd way to die, just from a shadow of a windmill. There's no stake through the heart. There's no silver bullet. There's no garlic.
I put down that he basically just gives up. Which I empathised with.
Essentially, what happened was we got to 1 hour and 25 minutes.
Yeah.
And
we have got to wrap this up.
Yeah. So you don't see what happens to the other two brides of Dracula in their nightdresses.
No.
The titular characters of the film.
Yes.
You never seen
them. And then Peter Cushing and the lady who was touted as the next Brigitte Bardot have a nice cuddle, and then it says, does it say the end? It probably does, doesn't it?
We just watched the credits go over a burning model of
of a Spitfire.
Yeah.
No coda, as usual.
Yeah.
No coda, we've hit 1 hour 30, guys. Sorry, no one, we need to clear the cinema for the next one.
Well, we've got the leech woman coming up. So we need to...
And then Cliff Richard's summer holiday.
Yeah.
Go and buy yourself some jelly beans or something.
Yeah. Yelly babies.
Yeah, so what do we think, guys? I loved the first hour. Mm. I think the last, or what other podcasts would say, the third act, let it down, because it's just kind of becomes a bit mechanical then.
Yeah, for me, it looked amazing, but I think the story was nothing really. That I feel like
it sets up a great story,
and it doesn't
deliver on anything. I like the mother, the mad maid, him chained up in the castle.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then it's all just like, oh, we've released basic him now. And then it's like, no, it goes very quickly into Hammer tropes. Then of like,
I like the idea that there was a cult of Dracula which were left behind after the events of the first film.
Also interesting, yes.
Yeah, but I feel like, how on earth did they get away of putting the word Dracula on the title of this film? It's just tenuous.
They owned the copyright, yeah. I guess.
It demeans what they've done with the film, which is actually not a bad film, just by making it look like it's a cash-in, doesn't it? Because it's so many things mention Dracula at that era, and they've got nothing at all to do with anything to do with Dracula.
They should have kept the Disciples of Dracula as the
title.
And just the way, when you look at the trailer, the way they were trying to market this is like, it's in a girls' school. It's going to be like sexy vampires. And it's like stuff you've never seen before with like sexy women. And it's going to be amazing. Yeah. And it's like, it's nothing to do with that at all.
Yeah.
My thought was like, I feel like this could have been the first Van Helsing film. They should have just called it Van Helsing, but then brought him into the film earlier.
A Van Helsing series would have been a really good idea. I think it starts really well as a gothic thriller, and it ends as a quite by-numbers kind of potboiler, which is a shame, really.
I think if it didn't look so good, it would have been even terrible. Worse. I've given it a two, mainly for what it looks like. Yeah. How about you, James? What have you got in it?
Same. I agree with John's assessment. Starts off as like a quite interesting gothic horror story. It becomes very, very formulaic. However, I did really, really enjoy the aforementioned article, and that gave me a new perspective on it. Mm. And also, I love finding out that Van Helsing is a philosophy graduate. Yeah. So that's 2 out of 5 for me too.
Yeah, John, what are you going to give it?
For the context of the article, in a kind of socio-historical thing, it's kind of a 3 or a 4. For the actual film, it's like a 1 or a 2, isn't it? Which is a shame, because the first hour is great, but then it's just like, which is really disappointing. And it does make me think, how does something as awful as Life Force
get a 5 out of 5?
No, be consistently more entertaining than a film which is obviously a better film, but is less entertaining. It's quite weird. What you find entertaining and what touches one part of your brain compared to something else is quite an interesting thing. And I don't think anyone knows how to put their finger on what the difference is, really.
I would say universally on, because I put out on Twitter, what do you think of it? Everyone loves it. The people are putting it as either their favourite or in their top 3 Dracula films.
That's mental.
Yeah. So
considering Dracula's not even in it. Really?
Yeah. So that's interesting. But
maybe they're just not as intelligent as us.
The views of John do not reflect the views of the General Witch Finders podcast.
But I think that explains why it won the poll, because we should have mentioned that every 10 episodes we do tend to open this up to our listeners, and this was the one that barely won the poll. It was between this and the one with Cleggan, which I really wish.
Taste the Blood of Dracula is a very, very different film, and it would be interesting to review it to look at the difference in this, because there's only like 8 or 9 years between the two films, and it is literally an ocean of difference, because the scenes in a brothel, there's prostitutes,
snakes, I seem to remember.
There's all sorts of mad shit.
Yeah.
There's Ralph Bates from TV's Dear John. Dear John. Dear John.
Since you've been gone. Or something like
by
that.
The time you will have read this, I'll be gone.
with Vince. Remember Vince?
Yes. And he wasn't really I don't cool remember at all. Well, but he was a character. Yeah. Oh,
I remember being shocked when Ralph Bates died. died very young, didn't he?
He did,
like 1994 or something. But it's a very different film, and there's only 9 years between those films. Whereas now, I don't think you have 9 years between films now. You don't have a quantum leap in terms of feel and content, do you, anymore?
A lot was changing.
Like, you know, one Tom Cruise Mission Impossible film is now much the same as another.
I don't know, man. If you've watched Mission Impossible 2, like, recently, it's insane. We've got some long hair and doing lots of, like donuts John on Woo. A motorbike and stuff. Yeah.
But the one that's up. Like Mission Impossible Ghost Nation or whatever the fuck it's called, that's on every night on film 4 now, looks almost exactly the same to, like, the one that was in the cinema, like, last week. It's just him looking short and muscular, isn't it, and jumping off things on a motorbike.
In slow motion,
whereas this is, like, the beginning of the 60s and the end of the 60s was just, like, the most insane explosion that you can really come to think about, really, culturally. And the Hammer films really reflect that, because they chucked it all in with the kitchen sink. And by the time you get to something in the early 70s like The Vampire Lovers, you've just got it all on display. And you're just like, this is mad. Within 13 years, they've gone from, like, very kind of, not closeted, but kind of, like, very coquettish female characters to just vampires with their tits out at literally every opportunity. And brought back to life out of a coffin just because a bit of blood is sprayed on them.
Yeah. Did you think that, when watching this, it made me think of the Twins of Evil? There was certain aspects of this which were very Twins of Evil-esque.
Yeah, but look, how different is this film to Twins of Evil? Like, Twins of Evil is probably one of the best later Hammers because it's got quite good production values. But there's still way too much just pointless, gratuitous nudity and, like, loads of, like, carry-on style.
Stroking,
like,
of candles.
Yeah, and the guy that's, like, the hero is just, like, heavy panting anytime, like, a woman walks in the room and stuff. And it's like, this film is more realistic, isn't it? Because it's just, like, it's more of a kind of, it doesn't have to throw everything into the mix to kind of keep the viewer's attention. I think the main thing is that this film isn't necessarily competing with television like the later films were competing with. People wanted to stay in and they wanted to watch Bob Monkhouse on The Golden Shot or Zed Cars. They weren't necessarily interested in horror films at that point.
I think someone on Twitter, at Hairy Git.
All right.
Yeah, he described it quite well. He said, it's the best Hammer films invoke childhood nightmares, and this certainly does. Ooh. The sets and the lighting are beautiful, and it's like walking into a Grimm's fairy tale. And I agree with that.
Yeah, I totally agree, but the last half hour is quite just formulaic and by numbers. Absolutely by numbers.
They've got to come up with a better way to kill the vampires at the end. I think that
bus has passed Cleves, because this film was made like 60 odd years ago or something. When was this made?
Oh.
60. How old does that make it? 63 years old.
Mm.
This film is older than Johnny Marr.
Great yardsticks to use.
Have we, any of us, got anything horrific to talk about this week?
Yes, I have, Ross.
What have you got there, John?
Well, Ross, as we mentioned earlier, the news is that Mark Gatiss, TV's Mark Gatiss, and of the League of Gentlemen, has announced that the new ghost story for Christmas is going to be the Conan Doyle story. Which is lot number 249.
Cool.
Which is a mummy story.
Ah, nice.
Which was written by Conan Doyle in the 1890s or 1880s, I think. So it's a bit of a change. It's the first one, I think, that Mark Gatiss has done which isn't an M.R. James one, which is a slight disappointment for me, but it is a very good story. And I think it's the first time that a mummy, in the story, I think it's the first time that the mummy was seen as the kind of evil protagonist in a story rather than just a kind of thing from Egyptian history. So it's quite a good kind of historical story. I've read the story and it's really good. So I'm looking forward to it. It's quite a good cast that I can't remember off the top of my head.
I think it's got Kit Harington out of
yes.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Who my friend Jane used to go out with, I think.
Really?
Oh, nice. Yeah, I think so. I like him. Yeah, he's a good actor. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward
to it. Okay, so let's just check. So previous ghost stories mean the tractate mid-off. Was yeah, that Emma James?
Emma James.
The yeah, Dead yeah. Room?
Well, The Dead Room, I think, was Mark wrote it himself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, fucking adverts. No.
don't remember that one.
Leave that in, please.
It just popped up. Do you want to buy the Radio Times? No. Martin's Close?
Yeah.
Oh, that one's James. Brilliant.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, yeah, with Judge Jeffreys.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah,
The Mezzotint.
Yeah, Mezzotint, yeah.
And Count Magnus. Those are yes. the ones he's done so far.
Yeah. So there's a few. I've got a list of the ones that I would want to do, and the one that I would want to do, I think it's called The Case of an Appearance and a Disappearance, which is a dream, which is mainly a dream sequence about a Punch and Judy show, which is the most cinematic short story you've ever read that is written before cinema was invented. It's quite mental, and I would really like to do that one. But, yeah, so I'm looking forward to it. I think it'd be really good. It's going to be one of the only things probably worth watching over Christmas, won't it?
Yeah.
The other things will be the Strictly Christmas special.
Doctor Who Christmas special.
Are they doing a Christmas special?
Yeah, Disney Plus accidentally leaked it's going to be on Christmas Day, and it's called sort of like The House on... I'll get the name. One second.
So that will be the new... That's not Tennant, that's the new Doctor.
Shooty, yeah.
Yeah, okay, interesting. Interesting, because they're still shooting around Cardiff.
That's the second series.
Yeah. Some listeners will be interested to know that I was recently in a room with Russell T. Davis.
Were you?
Took his photo, but I didn't speak to him. I just thought he should come and speak to me. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
By now, it's going to be called the Church on Ruby Road.
Oh.
Is the
new companion's called Ruby?
Yes. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. There James, what have you got for us?
My one is when I got my PlayStation 5, when I upgraded to a PlayStation 5, they said, oh, thank you for doing this. Here, have 6 months of Apple Plus. So I've had Apple for the last few months. There's Severance, which is brilliant, and I highly recommend everyone watch Severance. It's a really great series. But then the main thing, and for interest for our listener, would be they have done the Enfield Poltergeist.
Of course,
the Enfield Poltergeist is a great touchstone for this podcast.
This is what you two keep talking about, the fucking Lego bricks.
Lego. Yes! Right. So what they've done, it's really good because back in the 70s, the Enfield Poltergeist was really heavily recorded.
Yes.
They recorded so much of it. So what they've got is they've got all the original tapes, and they've had people act over the tapes.
Oh, wow.
As it were. And it's odd, but it's really good. It's really, really convincing. And as I said, if you're interested in this sort of thing in any way, shape or form, it's good because they don't rush it and they don't rush through it. And they, at the moment, of course, that Danny Robbins, The Uncanny Thing is out. And I find that this, the Enfield Poltergeist series, finds a nice balance between saying at the start, obviously there is no ghost, but at the same time as well, presenting it as that's creepy and that's weird and that's odd. And then as you get through the episodes, they kind of expand out as to, well, what was actually going on here? Mm-hmm. And that's really interesting too. Just saying kind of like the family dynamics that play there, the ages of the people involved. And then it all starts to kind of like make a little more sense. But the fact that, you know, people like Morris Gross, who was the main guy, and of course the amazingly named Guy Playfair, how much they bought into it.
Yeah, because Morris Gross's daughter died.
That's right. That's right. But I never realized that he got his son to turn up, who's now a lawyer,
His son, who's a mad skeptic, like really skeptical, going, oh, this is all balls. And he's like, no, come and talk to her. And they speak to him. And he's like, it was terrifying. It was, and then I was like, Jesus Christ, I've been spoken to by a ghost. And then, of course, they actually speak to all the parties involved.
Oh, really?
Today.
Is her name Helen?
Okay. No.
What's her name?
But anyway, but she's in it.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Cool.
Wow.
So,
as a real person, not someone playing her now.
No. They actually speak to the real her.
Wow, okay. That's interesting.
At the end. And the other sister as well. And it's really, really good.
They touched on it in a bit with the recent Uncanny TV series, didn't they? Which I thought was very interesting. Did either of you, both of you, watch the Uncanny TV series?
I've seen two of them.
Okay.
People keep telling me to watch it, so I'm being really quite like stubborn about not watching it. So should I?
Yes, it's really good.
All right, I will.
I think it survives the move to TV really well. Mm-hmm. I think two episodes of the three episodes are really strong. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the order, though. One of them isn't so strong, and it might be the one with the Enfield Poltergeist in it. Mm.
Yeah, there's a documentary about Enfield Poltergeist on Paramount Plus, and they go to the guy who is... what do they call it? The group...
The Society for Psychical Research.
It, yeah. So the guy who has their archives, he's essentially got these two big chalets in his back garden with like all of the... So he's got the box of all the tapes from the Enfield Poltergeist haunting. He's got the box of like all the bits of Lego that got thrown around and all that kind of stuff.
Yes!
Like, this is boxes and boxes of this stuff. And you feel like, I would just love to go and have a route through all of these things. Mm. Again, all bollocks, but, you know, listen to some of those... D60s, were they called D60s? With when you had like a 60-minute tape, a D90 and a D60?
The miniature ones.
Yeah.
On a dictaphone. Yeah, I had some of them. What we should review on this podcast is when Nick and Katrina from Paranormal Lockdown UK went to investigate the Black Monk in my birth town of Pontefract.
I'm up for it.
Because that's pretty wild. And I think
it's mainly puddles, isn't it?
I think that was the main of
that haunting.
Puddles of piss.
Yeah.
I think until recently, and I'm not sure if you still can, you could stay in the house. Someone had bought the house so people could go and stay in the house where the Black Monk had been seen. But also, on that bombshell, we should also go and visit the place in Gloucester where Zach Bagans has been.
Yes.
Buried. The old Ram Inn. We've got to go there.
I keep thinking about that. All the time.
Yeah.
So next time...
Christmas.
It's Christmas. So we'll be doing the BBC Ghost Stories...
Christmas!
next time will be the BBC Ghost Stories for Christmas. We'll be doing the Stalls of Barchester and the Treasure of Abbot Thomas.
Oh. So the best thing about the first one is Robert Hardy's clip-clop shoes.
That's your only bad name.
I re-watch it just to enjoy how clip-cloppy his shoes are.
Yeah.
Because he's walking around the cloisters of, I think it's Norwich Cathedral they use, and his shoes are insanely clip-cloppy. Fuck knows what they were made of, like aluminium.
Is he like brilliant. Roy Castle?
Yeah, they're like tap shoes. And it's brilliant. I love it. And it's like he's being followed at one point by someone else with clip-cloppy shoes on. And you're like, I just love how clip-cloppy these shoes are. Because no one has clip-cloppy shoes anymore, do they? Everyone's just got trainers now.
So if we see that episode and it's 4 hours long, it's because I've looped 3 hours of clip-cloppy shoes at the end of the episode.
And dear listener, if that doesn't serve as an amuse-bouche for what's coming next, I don't know what does. But thank you as always for listening.
Yes.
And everyone stay well. And until next time, we'll see you. We'll see you then.
Yeah, happy day.
Love, light, and peace.
You have been listening to The General Witchfinders. Support the show and continue the conversation at patreon.com/generalwitchfinders. Subscribe and spread the word at generalwitchfinders.com. Farewell. And don't have nightmares.
I've never seen that there's two windows in there.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like number 13, M.R. James. The one window disappears late at night.
That'd be quite
how's exciting. How's the service station getting on, James?
That's all right.
Amazing.
A shell?
That's what. As if John had like a high definition projection system, it would be of a garage.
I'd love that. Just watching a garage all night. That would be amazing, wouldn't it? People going
currently,
in.
There's only one car, and it's not at the pumps. So very quiet at the moment.
Do they still have like a late night window, James, for places like that where people go and buy stuff when they've got the munchies?
They do, but this one doesn't really utilise it. They shut it down at 11.
When I was younger, one of my uncles used to work in a garage overnight, and sometimes I got to go and like
hang out
in there with him you know, restock the shelves. And sometimes when he was like having a nap on the I'd sit up on the counter in my pajamas and like take the money off the people.
Wow,
that's so you, Cleves.
You never told me that.
Yeah.
Did you have a straw hat on as well, Cleves?
No, but it's the same one. It was his straw hat I was wearing in the picture you may have seen with the cravat and the and the waistcoat.
Oh Lord! Right,
let's get into it.
Start this.
Also, and before we get this going, Ross, I've got to say at some point, my friend Jo, who you met, I said to her, "Oh, you got to listen to the Life Force one. We give you a shout out, and then you cut it out."
Did I?
Yeah,
<it's not>
because it's all right because of the way you did the whole. Hang on, have we started yet? Have we started yet? The way you've edited, which is good. Yeah. But you obviously cut it out in the midst of all that. So I said to her, I'm so sorry. I'll try my hardest to say thank you on the next one. So we'll probably do that at the end or something.
Okay,
but okay, right. Okay, to the script. Right. Okay. Hang on, let me just get that right. Ross, I can just hear like a bit of whistling in my headphones.
Yeah, I can hear it too. Yeah.
It's a car outside with... a very loose alternator belt by the sound of it.
Yeah.
Okay. It's gone. Let me do that again.
That was the sound I used to, when my dad used to get up early to go to work. You could hear that noise as his car was warming up on the drive and it was pouring
the
water.
He needed to tighten his fan belt, didn't he?
Yeah.
But it was car was it, Cleves?
It was a Lada. Like a
wow.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it was like a beige Lada.
A beige Lada. I'd love a Lada now.
Yeah.
James, carry on. I don't want the guy to call us moronic. And No, it's fine. I think I like the sound of the fan belt. Go on, James.
Excellent. Right, okay.